Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, is either side going to give to end the standoff in Hong Kong?
But we begin with questions raised by news of the first patient to be diagnosed with Ebola while in the U.S., a man in serious condition at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. Our guest has been saying that more needs to be done to stop the epidemic in West Africa to prevent Ebola spread. Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci, your thought when you first heard of this man?
Well, my thought was that what I had been saying for some time now, that this is really inevitable, that one of these days, given the extent of the outbreak in West Africa, that someone is going to leave a West African country, get on a plane having been infected and feel quite well with no symptoms, so not knowing they're infected, and then land somewhere, be it Paris, London, Washington, New York, or whatever. This person wound up in Texas, and as it turned out, did not develop symptoms until a few days after having arrived in the United States. The person arrived on the 20th and developed symptoms on the 24th, went to an emergency room with symptoms on the 26th, and unfortunately was not noticed that this person was at a risk because the person came from Liberia and was let go. And then only 2 days later was the person rushed to the hospital in an ambulance because he was extremely seriously ill.
Well, Dr. Fauci, let me ask you some of the questions about that timeline you just laid out, because people have questions.
Sure.
Are you concerned that at this hospital, the epidemiologist from the hospital, Dr. Edward Goodman, said that we've had a plan in place for some time. In fact, we had a meeting this week, ironically, with all the stakeholders who might be involved. And yet, as you just said, when somebody came to them with symptoms of Ebola, having traveled from West Africa, they were sent away with antibiotics. Does that concern you?
Well, it concerns me and concerns others because, unfortunately, that happens. The CDC has been trying very hard with health alerts that when someone comes in with symptoms that are compatible with Ebola, it is very important to ask a simple question of travel history. And apparently that did not work this time. It's unfortunate. Hopefully there will be a lesson learned from this.
Well, yeah, one would hope so. But also, what is your thought of the damage done? Do you agree with Dr. Thomas Frieden of the Centers for Disease Control that the likelihood of many people being infected by this man is rare? He says there are a handful of people that he came in contact with. You agree?
I agree with Dr. Frieden on that. And I think the important thing to point out to the listeners is that we will not have an outbreak in the classic sense here because our capability, particularly the extensive experience of the CDC professionals in working out what we call contact tracing and to get in contact with and to follow and monitor people who have come into contact with this patient after the patient has gotten symptoms, because we know you don't transmit Ebola when you are completely free of symptoms. So there's a time window there from the time the person was symptomatic when the people with whom that person came in contact will be monitored by the CDC and the state health officials. And if the people become symptomatic, that's when you isolate them and observe them and make sure they do or do not have Ebola. That's the thing that prevents an outbreak from occurring, and that's the reason why Dr. Frieden said in the press conference yesterday that he was confident that they'd be able to put this out and control it because of their ability to do contact tracing.
And let's remind people, it's a system. It's a scientific system. The patient is isolated, but then anyone who came in contact is tested every day for 21 days.
Well, we say tested, you got to be careful. It's monitored to make sure, A, they don't have a fever and B, they don't have symptoms. And as soon as there's the slightest indication that they may be sick, and the best indication of that is if you have a temperature of 101.5 or more, and that's when you then say, okay, now we've got to put you in isolation so that you don't have contact with other people.
Right. And just for our listeners in the Dallas area, we know Ebola cannot be spread. It's not airborne. It can only be spread through the bodily fluids of people. But this man did go into a hospital emergency room when people didn't know he had Ebola. He was also in an ambulance, although the hospital says the ambulance, by the time he arrived in an ambulance, they had all precautions in place. But should people be worried if they were in the emergency room with somebody who might have been blowing their nose or sneezing?
The people in the emergency room would be considered as people who were in contact with that person. So they will be monitored in the way we just described, that they will have to take their temperature every day.
But this has raised so many questions. You know, why, just anecdotally, you hear people saying, well, if I was in West Africa and I thought I'd come in contact with someone with Ebola, I would come to the United States, too, because I know I'd get better care there. We're not at all speculating that this gentleman did that. But short of funds, what's to stop people from wanting to come to the U.S. to get the care they know they'll get?
That is an unlikely scenario. I wouldn't really be terribly worried about people who are infected deciding they're going to come to the United States and not tell anybody about it just so that they can get care. I think you'll likely see more since there is a continued expanding outbreak in West Africa, that I think it's quite feasible that we'll see another situation where someone will come over. We predicted this over the last several weeks, and in fact it happened. And I think that the listeners should also not be surprised if one of the people or more of those who came into contact with this person might actually turn out to be infected. We don't think there'll be an outbreak. In fact, we're fairly confident that there will not be an outbreak.
And you don't call that an outbreak, by the way, if one or two people are infected.
No. I think that a single secondary case does not constitute an outbreak.
And are you confident in the screening systems? This man was screened before he left. He had had his temperature taken before he left West Africa, but we don't yet know if he was screened along the way. I mean, are you confident?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident about the sequence of events associated with the travel. It is very clear that people do not transmit Ebola if they are without symptoms. This person arrived in the United States completely without symptoms.
Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci, thanks as always.
You're quite welcome.
All right, let's get to our other top story today. Hong Kong's government says it is willing to meet with protesters, but without preconditions. That's according to a report today in the Wall Street Journal. Protest leaders, for their part, say Hong Kong's chief official must resign by tomorrow. Beijing is signaling an even tougher stance, with Chinese state media calling on Hong Kong's residents to support, quote, decisive police enforcement to restore social order in Hong Kong. Perry Link is a longtime China scholar at the University of California, Riverside. He's with us via Skype. Professor Link, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, sir.
Well, do you see a way out of this? Who is going to give here, either side? Because it doesn't seem that the protesters have any real incentive to back down in Hong Kong. And it doesn't seem that the Chinese government is going to want to step away and allow protesters to get what they want.
That's exactly right. The students that are protesting are young and they have all the vitality of youth and they have some morale now, so they're charging forward. The government in Beijing, especially under the new leader Xi Jinping, has been unusually repressive. So it's a very tough call. One option that Beijing has, of course, is to throw the current CEO of Hong Kong, CY Leung, under the bus.
Throw him under the bus, though, and then do what?
Well, that's the key question. I'm glad you put it so bluntly. It would not have a long-term effect, because the fundamental problem is that Beijing wants to have authoritarian control and the students want to have a ground-up democratic system. That issue won't go away just because the leader goes away. Another option that I think Beijing has, although it's not a palatable one, is to find some incident where the students have gone too far and play it up and then try to split the movement. That would put in front of every Hong Kong person the dilemma of, should I stick with my ideals and support the students, or should I go for my own best interests and follow what the government's saying? This kind of dilemma has been used effectively by the regime inside China for a long time.
I think one of the things in the back of everybody's mind is Tiananmen Square and the protests that happened there. This is different, though. How do you think this is different from what happened in Tiananmen Square?
I was in Beijing at the time of the Tiananmen Square movement, and on the surface, the protests looked very similar. There was high morale and people handing water bottles to each other. But in Beijing 25 years ago, the students really didn't imagine that they would eventually face tanks and machine guns. The students in Hong Kong are not so naive now. They know that that's an option, and if they have to, they will retreat. They will be very bitter in their hearts, but they will retreat into their homes in order to avoid that kind of thing. But as you have just pointed out, that won't solve the long-term problem.
Well, what does solve the long-term problem, do you think?
I think the long-term problem in Hong Kong is the same as the long-term problem in China, and that's how can this great culture, this great nation, move beyond an authoritarian one-party system? The students in Hong Kong don't really want to face that very fundamental issue clearly. Some of the older leaders of the Democratic Party in Hong Kong are always doing that, and this leads to a little bit of a split between the younger and the older generations of the protesters. And maybe it's because I'm elderly. I think the older generations got that right. There is no way that Hong Kong can be independent and go its own way. Beijing will not tolerate that.
Professor, we're already hearing about people being arrested in mainland China who are sympathizing with what's going on in Hong Kong. What happens when more and more people from mainland China take a vacation in Hong Kong and they see what's going on and they go back to the mainland and tell people about it?
It's not just by traveling back. It's by the internet. And of course, the Beijing government is trying to do what it can to repress this kind of spread on the internet. But it's failing. It can't be completely bottled up. And it needs to be stressed that, you know, in my view anyway, the main reason why Beijing is worried about Hong Kong is precisely this spread effect. Because for decades, the Beijing government has been telling its own people that democracy is a foreign thing, it's difficult, it doesn't fit with our culture. If it comes, it will take a long, long time. Hong Kong is a spectacular counterexample to that. Taiwan is a wonderful counterexample to it. That is the real issue in the worries of the Beijing leaders.
That's Perry Link, a longtime China scholar at the University of California, Riverside. Thank you so much, Professor.
My pleasure.
There's a global forum going on this week at Boston University focusing on the future of the most popular major in America, business education. The headline is that it needs to change because students getting into business are not adequately prepared for today's corporate world. Kenneth Freeman is the dean of the Boston University School of Management. He's with us now. Welcome.
Pleased to be here, Jeremy.
So let's talk about what's going on right now, because after several years of declining applications, the number of people enrolling into MBA programs is finally on the rise. What changed? What happened?
Well, I think there's several factors that are really driving this renaissance, although it's a very small one. We'd had a number of years of declining numbers of people taking the admissions tests and attending MBA programs. And what I'd say now is it's really stabilizing. It's not one where there's rapid growth anymore, because people are fundamentally challenging the value of the MBA.
Rightly, do you think?
I believe there's plenty of reasons to say they're right.
Why?
The world's changed. Technology has changed. The ability to deliver education in different formats is now very prevalent. The world has become much smaller in terms of being a global economy. And frankly, most business schools haven't responded to the changing world.
And what should they have done?
The most important thing we can do is bring industry, the employers, if you will, and academia closer together. There's a major gap today, Jeremy, between what industry perceives of academia and what we perceive of ourselves. A recent survey by Gallup indicated that roughly 96% of chief academic officers believe we're doing a reasonably good job in educating the next generation workforce. On the flip side, a Gallup and Lumina Foundation poll in 2013 had a summary that said that 33% of business leaders agree or strongly agree that higher education prepares students appropriately for the workforce. 33% versus 96% on the two sides, a huge gap that we need to close. And that's why we're engaging in a massive global conversation about the future of business education.
There is also, it seems, a generation gap that the new generation of students doesn't want to work in the same corporate culture that existed 20, 30 years ago.
The millennial generation is wired slightly differently. Now, of course, I was a baby boomer and people were saying in my day that we were wired differently too. The millennials tend to be individuals, and I'll just share a story with you from one of the larger financial services firms, where they're talking about the fact that many of the millennials want to work from home by themselves at their computer and not have to engage with other people inside the firm or outside the firm. Basically saying, please leave me alone, tell me exactly what you want me to do, and leave the rest to me. Well, for business today and for the future, millennial or not, the way business gets done is people engaging with each other, coming to decisions, and making something better from it. And the lack of interest in many cases in being on teams, the power of ideas, is a major challenge for virtually any significant organization around the world. So how we untap the millennials to become maybe a little less self-centered, to becoming we-centered more than just being me-centered, is something I'm hearing from employers all the time.
You're saying that the millennials have to adapt to the system rather than the other way around?
Well, I think there's some of each, of course. But going from me to we is a very important adjustment that the millennials need to do. But there is more to this, Jeremy, as you just highlighted. We in the business school arena, we've got to change too. It's not just them, if you will, right? The millennials need to make some adjustments, but so do we. And the way for us to adjust is to make adjustments in terms of how we teach and what we teach, to ensure that our students are getting more experience in the real world, if you will, getting more internship experiences, engaging from consulting projects and other activities that are outside the classroom, where they have to work in teams and engage in a way where they're coming forward with ideas and learning, essentially, to work in a team environment and to see the power of their own ideas and the power of collective ideation as well.
And some might say the ability to operate in an ethical manner, something that we've seen has not been the case in a lot of businesses.
Very, very important point you're raising, Jeremy. The fact that business really took a real hit back in the late 2000, first decade of the new century, as a result of, one could argue, some significant lapses in decision-making of an ethical nature. Our need, a very important need for business schools, is in fact to help our students learn not necessarily how to be ethical, but how to make informed judgments when they're faced with difficult decisions so they can be striving to do the right thing.
How do you do that, though?
It's not easy. It's not easy. It's hard to teach judgment. It's easy to teach concepts and principles. It's not so easy to teach judgment. What we believe is most important to help make it happen is experiential learning, the opportunity for students to be placed in situations where they need to make adjustments, need to make a decision, to take the complex array of information they have available and decide what is their purpose and how do they come out on the tough decisions. By helping students live that, partly through traditional case studies, but even more importantly, moving forward, real-time case examples, engaging with companies on real-time issues of the day. We believe, whether it relates to ethical decision-making, becoming more entrepreneurial and innovative in their thinking, that business schools can, in fact, become more relevant once again for the world of business.
I've seen some reporting that there are fewer graduates of business schools going into Wall Street than before, that now they're going into other places. Is that your experience?
It's absolutely correct. There's a lot of different reasons for it. Certainly the crisis of the great economic recession really changed people's views. And where the hot ticket is today is technology and innovation. Small is good, and the ability to make a difference and make impact is very, very powerful. Students and graduates don't want to wait a long time in a large corporation before they can see the results of their labors.
Well, and in fact, some of them don't even want to go to graduate school. They just want to get the job right out of undergrad.
And in fact, there are some firms in Silicon Valley today that are telling high school graduates, don't go to get your undergraduate degree. Just come to work for us. We'll pay you six figures. Why would you need to go spend, call it $250,000 a year for 4 years to get your undergraduate degree when you can come to work for me now and earn $100,000 on day one out of high school?
And what do you tell those students about why they shouldn't do that? Because clearly, as the dean of a management school, you would prefer that they do go and get their degree.
What we think is most important in the opportunity opportunity to get a business degree or a liberal arts education, for that matter, is the ability, when you come to a residential experience in particular, to learn much more about who you are and what you stand for. That taking that dwell time after you've graduated from high school to discover who you are and what you truly want to be without being encumbered by a paycheck, if you will, is liberating for a student and one that we believe in the long haul will yield better output for society in terms of graduates than just diverting from an undergraduate experience in particular. On the MBA side of the house, I think there's an argument to be made that perhaps the MBA is not nearly so important now as it was, say, 20, 25, 30 years ago. So many schools in my world are seeing a rapid expansion in enrollment at the undergraduate level as their MBA programs feel a bit more pressure. And I don't think that's not by surprise. Parents want their children to get a job when they get out of college if they're going to invest heavily. They want an ROI. And employers more and more now are telling me, you know, I just as soon hire undergrads. Then we can shape them culturally. We can teach them what they need to know beyond the fundamentals. Whereas at an MBA, the MBAs who may come to work for us tend to feel like they're entitled. Today, over 20% of the students graduating from undergraduate schools in this country have a business degree, the most popular degree in America. And oh, by the way, though, the undergraduate business school majors that graduate spend the least time on homework of any major at the undergraduate level. So we have lots of work to do.
Kenneth Freeman, Dean of the Boston University School of Management, thanks very much. And full disclosure, of course, WBUR, which produces Here and Now, is a part of Boston University.
Today, General Motors and Chrysler announced that sales are up almost 20% over last year, and GM saw that rise, selling more than 220,000 vehicles in September, even with the recall of millions of cars with faulty ignition switches that have been linked to deaths. Overall, the auto industry has seen about a 10% rise in car sales, which are seen as a key indicator of U.S. consumer confidence. Let's bring in CNN's Maggie Lake. Maggie, what's happening? Why all these sales?
Yeah, Robin, I think this is really the story of the recovery playing out before us. I mean, we weren't just back to school shopping. We were out making major purchases. You have a stable economy, people feeling a little bit better about jobs, and financing and leasing is getting easier to secure. And we know that's important for those big ticket items. And finally, there's some terrific deals out there. There was pretty heavy discounting, especially if you look at trucks and SUVs, and those were some of the models that were really moving off the lots.
I was going to ask, what kinds of cars were people buying?
Yeah, we're still addicted to the big cars, you know, and it's not just the housing. It's the folks with families trudging off to soccer practice. But when you do have those kind of discounts, you are going to get people out. And for all of the, especially for GM and Chrysler, it was really the trucks, the SUVs, and the crossovers, too. Not just the big gas guzzlers, but the crossovers continued to do really well.
Well, talk about General Motors, though. Earlier this week, we got the news that the number of deaths linked to GM's defective ignition switches, if the keys are too heavy, you know, on the keychain, they were just shutting it off, had risen to 23 terrible stories, and they've recalled more than 2 million cars. So how is it that their sales have shot up?
I think that's a really good question, especially because there has been so much press about this and about the recalls and the deaths and GM's handling of it. Listen, I think there are a couple things going on. First of all, if you price it, you know, people will maybe put those safety concerns behind. A lot of people do think it's something that happened in the past. And if GM's making some of the newer models very attractive and some of their incentives were up 30% year over year, so they're bringing those price tags down. When people come in for a recall, a lot of them, we are hearing anecdotally, are being told by the dealers, hey, we'll take that car off you and take a look at this new model we have with this really attractive price. And also another big thing to keep in mind is I think GM and also Chrysler, by the way, really taking advantage of the fact that Ford is transitioning off some of its older models to some brand new, especially when you're looking in the truck segment, this brand new F-150. And some of GM's strongest performance was in the Silverado pickup area. So to a certain extent, GM and Chrysler seem to be benefiting from this sort of transition period for Ford.
Well, but talk about that, because Ford saw a slump in sales. Is that why?
I think it's a large part of it. That's certainly how Ford is playing this. They're weaning people off those models. They want them to take a look at this new, especially this F-150. The company really banking their future on this. It's made of aluminum. It's supposed to have much better gas mileage. So they don't want people coming in and looking at those older models. So they're retransitioning on the manufacturing front. But I do want to mention with Ford, too, they are very exposed to Europe. So I don't think we can just think that this is transition to new models.
What do you mean by that?
They are the fourth biggest seller of cars cars in Europe. They're more exposed to Europe. They have more business in Europe than GM and Chrysler do. They have a big presence there. Europe was supposed to be recovering, and their economy is just not. While the U.S. is taking off, Europe is actually – there are fears they're going back into recession. So that weakness really is taking a hit on Ford. They thought those sales would be better, and they're not. They're lagging. And that's why they gave that big profit warning just a few days ago.
And you say Mustang sales fell almost 30% in September as Ford, as you say, tries to sell off the old models ahead of the release of a new Mustang. They got to get rid of the old ones. CNN's Maggie Lake on the view from the car lot, which is pretty darn good. And
it certainly is.
Yeah, she says that's one of the best signs of the economy. Maggie, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
It's here and now, and there are just 33 days left until the midterm election. So let's get to our weekly Senate tracker. This week we're looking at Wyoming, where incumbent Republican Senator Mike Enzi is running for a fourth term against Democrat Charlie Hardy, a retired Catholic priest. Bob Beck is news director at Wyoming Public Media. He's with us from Laramie. Bob, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Good to be here.
And I don't think of Wyoming as a swing state at all. It is a very deep red Republican stronghold. Is it going to be an uphill climb for the Democratic candidate?
It is going to be more than an uphill climb. It'll be a couple of mountains for Charlie Hardy to climb. And biggest reason is because of money. Senator Enzi has raised well over $3 million. I spoke with Charlie Hardy this morning, and he's somewhere right around $40,000 to $50,000. So on that alone, it will be very tough.
Well, let's talk about the candidates here. And Senator Mike Enzi, we'll remember, won the primary easily after Liz Cheney, the daughter of the former Vice President Dick Cheney, dropped out of the race. Tell us more about Mike Enzi.
Mike Enzi is somebody who's he's conservative, but I wouldn't call him a right winger. He's probably more of a moderate Republican. Senator Enzi has been very effective, I think, in the Education and Health Committee since he served in the Senate. He is certainly a strong fiscal conservative. One of the things I know Liz Cheney wanted to go after Senator Enzi about was his working across the aisle and compromising. That's something Senator Enzi actually does believe in, and that was something she was going to attack him on. So, again, I would say very strong Republican, but a very moderate Republican.
Well, let's listen to some of him. Here he is speaking on KIML 1270 AM out of Gillette, Wyoming. He's talking about how he photographs Wyoming's landscape, and that gets him talking about the environment.
You know, I take pictures when there's haze out there, too. And it's usually from forest fires, either west of us or in Canada. And that's where the real haze comes from, because we're not managing our forests properly. And it doesn't have a lot to do with coal and the energy business in Wyoming. And so we ought to be a little more concerned about that than trying to solve that problem by putting a lid on energy in the United States.
Is environmental regulation a big deal for people in Wyoming?
Absolutely. I would say that, well, it is the number one driver of our economy here in Wyoming, oil and gas in particular. Wyoming is the nation's leading coal state in the country. It's certainly big in his neck of the way up there in Gillette, Wyoming. And so if it's very difficult to get certainly any of our Republican members of Congress or the governor or even our previous governor who was a Democrat to think that the EPA rules and those types of thing are a good idea.
Well, let's talk about the challenger now, Charlie Hardy. One of his campaign mottos is run with Charlie. He says he's running with the people of Wyoming. He's not taking money from political action committees or corporations. He's been very critical of Senator Enzi for taking money from PACs. So here he is speaking with KCWY out of Casper, Wyoming.
All of our contributions have come from individual people, and I think that's what politics in the United States should be about. My parents taught me that a politician should be someone who listens to the people and who accompanies them in their struggles. What you have today in Washington is people listening to money and accompanying those walking down Wall Street. And I think most people in Wyoming would like to see that change.
What more should we know about Charlie Hardy?
I think the most interesting thing about him, he's a former Catholic priest. He has been outside the country. He's been involved in a number of volunteer efforts. And he is just somebody who, frankly, wanted to run 4 years ago as an independent candidate, this time came back as a Democrat, really would like to raise the minimum wage. He's very concerned about money issues, as you just highlighted, and really thinks that's part of the problem in Congress. We've got too much money in there and too much influence.
But no political experience.
None whatsoever. He is somebody who's kind of learning as he goes, it would seem. And he's, boy, you talk about the epitome of a grassroots campaign. His fundraising efforts involve sometimes very humbling numbers, $5, $10, $15. That's not exactly what Senator Enzi has gotten from PACs.
And so why is he not gaining any traction?
It's a tough thing when you look at our state where it's a 2-to-1 margin for Republicans over Democrats, and it's been since the 70s. Tino Roncalio was the last member of Congress from the state of Wyoming who was a Democrat, and it's just a tough go. Dick Cheney, of course, won that race after Tino Roncalio stepped down, and it's been Republicans ever since, and I think just nobody wanted to run for this race, so we do have some very effective Democrats in the state. We have a couple that are former governors that are sitting out there, one in particular who could run at some point, but most of the Democrats were planning on sitting this one out. They just didn't have a candidate with much experience that was willing to run.
What role are the Cheneys playing in this election, if any?
None whatsoever now. She certainly would have been formidable for Senator Enzi. I don't think there's any doubt about it. She would have had a lot of money. She was ready to attack, and because of a personal problem within her family, had to step out of the race. I don't know if we'll see her again, but she has remained in the state. And that would have been definitely a heavyweight fight had the two of them gotten together. I have, some of the polls showed early on that Senator Enzi would have won that race, but you never know, because I think she would have attracted the people who would definitely come out to vote, and she might have made things difficult for him.
Bob Beck, news director at Wyoming Public Media, talking with us about the Senate race in Wyoming. Bob, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And from politics to sports now, you may have heard our story earlier this week about the Kansas City Royals making the baseball playoffs for the first time in 29 years. Well, after midnight last night, the Royals had a huge celebration at Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City after a walk-off win over the Oakland A's in the American League wildcard game.
Now looking for a two-out hit. Pass forward into left field. The Kansas City Royals are walking off into the ALDS.
That hit by Salvador Perez in the bottom of the 12th inning. The 12th inning gave the Royals a 9-8 win and sent them on to the American League Divisional Series against the LA Angels. The last time the Royals made the playoffs was in 1985. That is the longest postseason drought of any major sports team in North America. And by the way, as the New York Times pointed out the other day, back in 1985, you could still smoke on airplanes. Only 6 states had laws that required wearing seatbelts. And Back to the Future was in theaters. On the Billboard charts, Madonna's Like a Virgin, Money for Nothing by the Dire Straits, and Careless Whisper by Wham! Featuring George Michael. And maybe with that song for inspiration, the Royals did win the World Series back in 1985. You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Here and Now. When people emigrate, they take all that they own, including their music.
It was a far right king. We left fair Scotland's strand.
Now, a beautiful new coffee table book traces the journey in the 18th and 19th centuries of the people of Scotland to Ireland and then to the mountains of Appalachia, where their music merged with sounds from African, German, and Native Americans. We were reminded of this recently when we spoke to fourth and fifth generation Scottish Americans in the American South during the recent vote for independence. This book is about their ancestors. Wayfaring Strangers, the musical voyage from Scotland and Ulster to Appalachia, comes with a beautiful CD. The book's authors both have Scottish roots. Both are at WUNC in North Carolina. Doug Orr is founder of the Swannanoa Music Gathering. But let's start with Fiona Ritchie, familiar to NPR listeners as host of The Thistle and Shamrock. And Fiona, you know so much music. You had to get the CD down to 20 songs. What were you looking for?
Well, we were primarily looking to trace the story of the music starting in Scotland, moving through Northern Ireland on into the USA, down into Southern Appalachia, where the music, you know, morphs and changes and evolves. And we wanted to reflect this on a CD tracks 20, which is quite a difficult thing to do. And indeed, we could have played a lot more music. But I think we picked some that show off some of the key tradition bearers in the tradition. And also we put together a discography. So if people want to explore it further.
Well, let's listen to a little. The first song, people of Scottish descent might have guessed, Barbara Allen. Let's listen to a little.
Was in the merry month of May, when rosebuds were a-swelling, sweet William on his deathbed lay, for the love of Barbara Allen.
So a number of performers on this particular performance of Barbara Allen, but we heard Dolly Parton. Dolly Parton has some Scotch.
She sure does. Scotch-Irish ancestry and English, and very proud of it. She wrote the foreword to the book as well.
She writes in the foreword that her ancestors, the Partons, came from Gloucester in England, but other Partons may have gone to Scotland. There's different spellings. But maybe even more important, she grew up in the Smoky Mountains listening to these ancient ballads that crossed oceans. Tell us about Barbara Allen. What else, when you hear it, makes it Scottish?
It's sad. That's one of the things. You know, Scots do like to sing of broken hearts and sad songs of parting and of unrequited love, lost love, death. But also it has that sort of soul to it that comes from Scottish music and Irish music and Appalachian.
Let's listen to another beautiful voice. This is Cara Dillon singing The Winding River Row.
Some poet sing of a noble king, or of a sweetheart fair. Some tell a tale of ships that sail with treasures rich and rare.
It just goes right through you. She mentions poets. There's a reference in the book to Robert Burns. In 2009, Scottish Television, you write, conducted a poll who should be the greatest Scot. He won 500 poems to his name. But draw the line, as you do, from Robert Burns to Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan.
Well, Robert Burns was a wonderful poet. He also really liked to collect music. And as a labour of love, he travelled the length and breadth of the country collecting small snippets of songs. Woody Guthrie really was of that same spirit. He travelled around as a sort of troubadour, tuning into the traditions of the people that he encountered. And most notably, Bob Dylan, who reached back, having been inspired by Woody Guthrie, who in turn was inspired by Burns. Dylan reaches back to the Burnsian approach of picking up bits and pieces of ballads, even just ideas, little bits of tunes, and repurposes them, recreates new songs for a new generation. So they're all part of an ongoing tradition of song creation, songwriting that really is rooted in tradition.
Farewell, pretty Sarah, I bid ye adieu. But I dream of pretty Sarah wherever I go.
We interviewed Pete Seeger at his home up on the Hudson, Robin, and he told us the story of Woody Guthrie, his comrade, in the Merchant Marine going to Scotland and seeking out everything he could find about Robert Burns, because he was a kindred spirit to Woody, and both of them egalitarian, writing about the common man.
Yeah, well, and then Woody Guthrie wrote a poem, as you remind us, for Robert Burns, to that man Burns, and it begins, "Dear Robert Burns, your words turned into songs and floated upstream and then turned into rains and drifted down and lodged and clung to drifts of driftwood to warm, heat, and fertilize new seeds." Quite something. You mentioned this sort of inspiration from Burns to Guthrie to Dylan and Seeger. Let's listen to Pete Seeger singing The Farmer's Cursed Wife.
There was an old man lived over the hill. If he ain't moved out, he's living there still. Sing pa de ing ding da de ing ding di ing da de ing ding di ing da de ing ding di ing day. Well, the devil come up to him one day, said, one of your family I'm gonna take away. Singing pa de ing ding da de ing ding di ing da de ing di ing da de ing ding di ing day.
And then there's Doc Watson, the blind guitar virtuoso from Deep Gap, North Carolina. He's on the CD with Shady Grove.
Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, I say. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound to go away, Piccadilly. Yeah.
What does it do to you when you hear these songs, given these different lives?
It's a universal story in many ways, Robin, because the immigration, the movement of peoples around the world goes on to this day, and we need to remind ourselves that they bring with them their stories, their homesickness for the old place. It's a very human story, and after all, we are a nation of immigrants.
Well, it's funny you mentioned, because the recent Scottish vote reminded us, although we hadn't forgotten, that my dad's mom was a McLaughlin, came to Ellis Island, one of the oldest clans in Scotland. My father's brother was Lachlan McLaughlin, son of a McLaughlin. And so we started doing some research. And, of course, it's a storied clan, goes back to the 5th century. But there also was somebody in 1646 during a civil war who incited terrible moments there. In fact, someone called him a criminal lunatic. But the legacy, does include this music.
You know, this was a very kind of feisty bunch of people, and they brought some of that with them when they came to the Appalachians, most certainly. And it was also what allowed them to survive, you know, in very difficult circumstances.
As a matter of fact, my own clan, Orr, is a suffix of MacGregor, and the MacGregors were proscribed, meaning outlawed, for 175 years in the Highlands.
Congratulations.
Rob Roy being one of the most famous. So those of us who trace our ancestry back to those days in the Highlands, there are skeletons in every closet. It makes better songs and stories, too.
And if you listen closely, you'll hear some of those stories told in Songs in the Appalachians. Fiona Ritchie, Doug Orr, their new book is Wayfaring Strangers, The Musical Voyage from Scotland and Ulster to Appalachia. Thank you both. A beautiful, beautiful coffee table book and lovely CD. Thank you.
Thanks a bunch.
Amen, Robin. Thank you, and here and now. We appreciate you.